Friends, Romans, countrymen, well, 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 here we are again, gathered to enjoy yet another missive from the Honorable Gaius Julius Caesar's campaign in Gaul. I trust you all had a good Saturnalia. Before we commence, I would like to acknowledge the kind patronage of Thomas Cad, an advocatus from the distant land of Terra Australis. An argument had with Cad is an argument worth having. As you may recall, the illustrious Caesar, if looks could kill then he'd do time, was enjoying a well-earned winter in Hither Gaul. That was before a terrible tribe of Belgae arrived, intent on razing Rome to the ground. These are the words of Caesar, conveyed by Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. While Caesar was wintering in Hither Gaul, as mentioned above, frequent rumors were brought to him, and dispatches also from Labienus informed him that the Belgae, whom I have already described as a third of Gaul,
see Book 1, were conspiring against Rome and giving hostages each to other. The causes of their conspiracy, it was said, were to follow, commence with bullet points. Hither Gaul, off we go.
It's 57 BCE and Caesar is spending the winter in what our translation calls Hither Gaul. He calls it Gallia Citoria, which means nearer Gaul. We sometimes call it Cisalpine Gaul, Gaul this side of the Alps. Mm. And this is a standard way for Caesar to begin a book because each book is a year, as we've mentioned. And of course, during the winter, he's not campaigning. So he starts each year in the Northern Hemisphere winter and he's going to be somewhere else. He's going to be in Northern Italy or, you know, far away from the action. It's interesting that he starts this time with him because the first book we saw started with Gaul and that geographical description of Gaul. And where Caesar starts books, I think, is quite interesting. He moves it around a little bit, as we'll see. So here he says, when Caesar was wintering, he hears some news. That's mm-hmm. how it's going to continue. So he's going to have to respond to that news, kind of as he did in Book 1. But in Book 1, it took a bit longer. He didn't appear until Chapter 7.
Yeah, he did a big preface on here's the situation of the lay of the land.
Exactly.
But he's also assuming that you know all that backstory now because you would have kept up with what happened in Book 1 because why wouldn't you? This is Caesar we're talking about. So now he's just getting straight to the action. What's Caesar doing? Having a good winter in the chalet and called to action.
Hey, he's working.
Yeah, of course he is.
As he tells us elsewhere, that's when he goes to do his other proconsular job, which is to hold the assizes, as it's called, which is basically law courts. So he's been doing his judicial duty in the non-campaign season. But it's also important that at the end of Book 1, there's not necessarily a reason for him to go back after that because he has beaten the Helvetii, he's beaten the Germani. Now we need to have another situation to draw Caesar in. So we're not yet at the space where we've created a province. We've just kind of put out the bushfires, as it were, that have arisen from those two groups. But we need to hear some news that's a reason for Caesar to come back from Hither Gaul.
Mm-hmm. So the news comes in the form of a letter from his second-in-command, Titus Attius Labienus. And this message essentially says, Caesar, there's a situation you should be aware of.
Exactly. The Belgae are causing trouble. They're conspiring against Rome. And the kind of proof of this, which we saw with the Helvetii in Book 1, is that they're giving hostages to each other. That means the individual peoples within the Belgae, who are one of the three of the tripartite division of Gaul that Caesar drew up, the individual peoples within the Belgae don't absolutely trust each other. So if they give hostages to each other, then they have to stay true to their conspiracy, as it were, to their confederation.
Right, so as soon as they start doing this, it's something to worry about.
Yeah, and remember the Belgae were the group that are closest to the Germani and the ones he said were the toughest in Book 1. So already we've got this awareness that this could really be dangerous because they're incredibly hardy and savage and therefore they might be hard to fight.
And this general, this second-in-command that he's mentioned, Labienus, is one of the very few people that he actually name checks.
Yes, and he gets a lot of name checks. I've just looked him up in the index of the Lurb, and there were about 20 places where his name is mentioned, and that's far more than anybody else.
Mm. So essentially, this is the Belgae version of Romans go home. They're putting up their graffiti on the wall in 10-foot letters. Please give me the correct Latin here, Rhiannon.
Romani ite domum.
Thank you.
Well, at least according to...
Did you conjugate anything that you needed to there?
I think I've got it all. I used the imperative.
Right, good, good, good to hear. It wasn't just that for their reason. So what else did they give for their... Well, what did Caesar give for their justification?
Well, Caesar says they have various reasons. He says that all these could be happening at the same time or it could be any one of them. In the first place, he says, with all Gaul pacified, which is a phrase that he likes, and that's sort of a phrase for the future now, but the Belgae themselves are looking forward to that time with fear that they might themselves have to face a Roman army. So they're worried that basically the Romans are coming too close to them.
Yeah, so they're anticipating that they're next.
Yes. Also, he says, they were being stirred up by certain of the Gauls who had either been unwilling that the Germani should stay longer in Gaul, and they were now no less distressed that a Roman army should winter and establish itself in Gaul. Now, that's kind of a similar reason that the Romans are there, but it suggests that there are murmurings going on and that they're worried that what happened with the Germani coming over has now basically been replaced by the Romans coming over. Third, and this is my favourite one, the Gauls are just fickle. For sheer fickleness and inconstancy, they were set upon a change of rule. They're just always changing their minds about things, and they don't want the Romans there at the moment, but that could change next week. This is one of the tropes that we get with Caesar, that the Gauls, in various circumstances, are inconstant. So they might make a decision to attack, and then they change their minds.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
So we'll see more of that. Also, he says, and this is often something that comes up at the end of these kind of descriptions, that certain men in Gaul were more powerful chiefs, and they had the means to hire men, and they wanted to make themselves kings. So there are certain people who are jostling for overall power. There's this constant undercurrent of there might be a chief who wants to be king of all Gaul, and the Romans can stop them doing that. So there are four different reasons there, and all of them kind of interacting together, he says, make the Belgae rise up.
Okay, but we've got to take Caesar's word for it, I suppose.
Absolutely, yes, it's all coming through him.
Caesar enrolls two new legions.
He does. So he now has 8 legions in Gaul. He enrolls the 13th and 14th legions now. And he gets one of his second-in-commands called Quintus Pedius to take them into what he calls Gallia Celtica, Celtic Gaul, which is the bit that isn't Belgium, Belgica, and the bit that isn't Aquitania, which is the vast majority of modern France, really. He takes them there to verify and report back. And they indeed confirm that the Belgae are jostling around and intending to rise up in a conspiracy. So Caesar knows he has to be there now. He gathers troops and he gets there. Remember, he's in basically northern Italy, and he gets to what is now northern France, Belgium, within a fortnight. And that includes the gathering of the troops. So again, as we saw at the beginning of book one, Caesar works really fast. He's never slow to get somewhere when he needs to be there.
I suppose that it's good that he justified it all and verified all the information rather than running off as soon as he got this letter, I suppose.
Yeah, and he often puts himself in contrast to the Gauls in this way. So they will often just respond to unverified rumour. He always makes sure he gets the news, or he tells us he has anyway, that there is a good reason for him being there. Remember, he does in a way have to justify this to the Senate and the people back home. So it is important that he establishes that. He also tells us, which is another contrast with the Gauls, that he has ensured the food supply. What our translation calls the corn supply. No, it isn't maize. It's grain, wheat, etc., which means they can make bread. An army marches on its stomach, which is not something Caesar said.
Yes. Now, one thing that book two does a lot of is establishing the different tribes of the Belgae, which it also did with the Helvetii, I suppose.
Yeah, the Helvetii were kind of the outliers, and they were further east in modern Switzerland of the Gauls as a whole. And I guess Caesar kind of simplified situations by having the Helvetii as the bad guys, as it were, of book one. Now, it's a bit more complicated with the Belgae because they're made up of different peoples. And some of them stay what he would think of as true to Rome. They inform to Rome, and some of them are part of this uprising against Rome.
Now, at this point, we meet one of their friends being the Remi.
Yes. And they are very keen, this is in chapter 3, to identify themselves as on the good side, on the Roman side. All right. In other words, we're not part of this conspiracy. They don't want to be targeted by the Romans.
I've literally written in brackets here, we are good Belgae. It's yes. not us, it's everyone else.
Yes. Like children getting their excuses in early.
Yes. Well, that's essentially what they're doing, isn't it?
Very much so. What they say, and we get this, as we often do in Caesar, in indirect speech. So mm-hmm. there's informants from the Remi, and Caesar tells us that they said they had surrendered themselves and all of their stuff, all of their possessions.
It's literally got stuff, though.
Yeah, the translation is stuff. Do you want me to look up the Latin?
What's the Latin word for stuff?
It's probably res or some form of it.
Detritus.
Oh, good. That is a Latin word.
I know. Hang on. You sound surprised.
But I don't think it'll be what is used here. It's hard to actually translate because it's just the adjective meaning all things belonging to them.
Yeah.
So it literally is things.
So stuff.
It's not even specifically possessions, but it does mean their possessions.
Okay. So they surrendered themselves and their stuff.
Yes, to the protection and power of Rome. So in other words, we lay down all our possessions for you to make use of.
Mm-hmm.
That they had neither taken part with the rest of the Belgae nor conspired against Rome. Very, very clear, we are not against you. And that they were ready to give hostages, which is a form of subjugating yourself to, showing that you are to be trusted. Right? You can't go against Rome, not while you've got highborn Remi at their mercy, and to do Caesar's commands and to receive him into their towns to assist him with corn and everything else.
Right, so we'll feed you, we'll arm you, we'll give you our highborn, we're friends.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a very good buffer for Caesar. He's got them to call on and they're locals. Of course, they'll also have local information.
Mm-hmm.
And so Caesar's in a good position here to face down this uprising.
Book 2, Chapter 4 gives us a bit of ethnography, which we would have got at the start of Book 1.
We got a very general ethnography right at the start of Book 1 when we divided Gaul into three.
Yeah.
But here we get a bit more detail about the Belgae in particular.
Mm.
It's quite controversial, as is a lot of Caesar's ethnography. It's very hard for us to tell how accurate it is.
But this would be one of the very few sources that we'd have on the Belgae at the time,
which is part
it?
Of the problem, that this has sort of become lore. As in L-O-R-E.
Yeah, sure.
Most of the other sources we've got depend on Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
So he's on the spot. I guess he has more chance of having local information than others. But the Belgae themselves might be wrong about their remote origins. What they say here, though, is that most of the Belgae actually come from over the River Rhine. They're of Germanic origin. And that they'd come over a long while ago, which is very vague, of course.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of archaeological evidence for this, so it's not that likely. It may be true.
Mm-hmm.
For Caesar, it obviously explains why the Belgae are tougher. That's what he consistently says. And they'd come over, and this is also something we get again and again, is that the Germani want to come over because Gaul, the other side, the western side of the Rhine, is more fertile. So they'd come for the fruitfulness of the soil. And they'd driven out the Gauls who lived there. So they themselves are conquerors. They're hardy military souls. And that they have a lot of people there now.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Remi tells Caesar is that the Belgae have 296,000 troops.
So they list all the tribes and the troops that they have,
they
don't
do. They? They divide them up and say this is the total.
So yes, we've added it up there. So 296,000. And you're shaking your head.
Commentators just don't think this is possible.
Mm.
Caesar, even with 8 legions, has about 40,000 active troops. He's prepared to face. Mind you, he's very cautious in the way he does face them. The Romans are outnumbered, in all likelihood. Nearly 300,000, not that likely.
Yeah.
And remember that Belgica is a very small region of the whole of Gaul as Caesar divides it up. So this would be a very overpopulated area if that were true. And it's not the whole population, it's just the fighting troops.
Mm-hmm. So Caesar establishes his base of operations and it's right next to the Exona River. He leaves Sabinus and 6 cohorts to guard a bridge.
Yeah, so guarding a river, especially where you can cross a river, obviously strategically really important, and it will come into the subsequent battle.
Yeah, this base is built in it's almost an oxbow lake. Built it in a meander which means that it's essentially surrounded by the river.
Yeah, strategically a strong place.
Easier to defend, harder to get out of, I would suppose, but you would need a bridge there as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's left troops to guard that, and we get a bit more of a location as to where this is in relation to the Belgae.
So he's 8 miles, as he tells us, 8 miles from a Remi town called Bibrax. And of course, the Belgae, who are part of the uprising, have noted that the Remi are there with the Romans on their side.
Mm.
So they're preparing to attack Bibrax. Do you like the name Bibrax as being very Asterix?
Yes. That's a very good one.
And Caesar tells us here something about one of the Gallic methods of attack, if they're attacking a town.
These are the Belgae.
The Belgae who are attacking
Bibrax.
Yeah. So this is in chapter 6, subchapters 3 to 4. He says, a host of men is set around the ramparts, and when a rain of stones from all sides upon the wall has begun, and the wall is stripped of defenders, the attackers form a tortoise, move up to the gates, and undercut the wall. This was easily done on the present occasion, for when so vast a host hurled stones and missiles, no man might stand firm on the wall.
Mm.
So the Gauls here are using a technique which we might actually be familiar from Roman when we see them on the screen.
I was about to say I'd associate this with Roman tactics.
This is a technique part of this technique they use as well, the tortoise, which is when they put their shields over their heads and move as one towards a situation where there are going to be missiles thrown down at them.
Yeah.
So this means that if you're coming towards a town, you can avoid at least the worst of the attack of what people are going to be throwing from the walls.
Yeah.
And they get close enough that they, as this text says, undercut the wall. They're also themselves hurling, or they have others hurling missiles at the top of the wall. So that prevents those inside the town from attacking those down below.
Yeah,
and this is very successful. It stops any attack until the Belgae have got close enough to the wall that they can attack.
That association that we've got with this tactic being a Roman one, would they have learnt this from the Romans, or would the Romans have learnt this from them, or is it just a common tactic for back then? Or
I think it's something that we associate with the Romans because we see it so much, but it's obviously a common tactic in antiquity and it sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I think Caesar would tell us if he thought the Gauls had learnt it from the Romans, because he does like to do that.
Yeah.
But the Romans have been using this for a long time. It certainly goes back further than their association with, especially with these northern Gauls.
Mm. So Caesar sends off to Bibrax a bit of support. In the middle of the night, Numidian and Cretan archers. I don't know if there was something good about the Numidians in particular that made them archers, or if it's just the fact that he had enough of them to make a unit of them?
Cretans as well. He and other people often talk about particular peoples as having particular skills associated with them. And remember, these aren't Roman troops, these are auxiliaries. So these are people who are trained in that particular skill.
Yes.
And, you know, at this point at least, it's primarily Romans who do the core infantry fighting, and cavalry for that matter, whereas you have people who do other kinds of archery and so on, who might come from elsewhere. Mm. It's considered less important, although it's quite important at the start of an attack. They're not the core fighters. And yes, it often is by ethnicity. These are peoples who are attributed, who are given the attribute of being particularly good at this form of fighting.
Nice and multicultural too.
Indeed.
I forgot about the
Balearic slingers.
Where are they from?
So they're from the Balearic Islands, are Minorca and Mallorca, so modern Spain.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah, again, they're associated with this form of missile throwing, which is
a sling, a rock like a piece of tanned hide or something like that.
It's a David and Goliath.
Yeah,
type.
You swing it around. And those missiles often have messages written on them memory. Yeah,
they can do, yes.
Yeah, like this is for your mother and the horse you rode in on, kind of.
Much more obscene than that quite often.
I was, you know, trying to keep it as a family-friendly podcast. So he sends those reinforcements and the Belgae give up and instead lay waste of fields and pitch camp 2 miles from Caesar.
Yeah, so they're not able to penetrate the town of Bibrax. Mm. So instead they take it out on the surrounding land, which belongs to the Remi, remember? So let's get at some of the supply that's going to the Romans.
Sure.
And also get back at the Remi for not joining our uprising.
And pitch a camp really close to the Romans, provocatively close.
Yeah, so they're still there. They're still in the fight.
So Caesar's troops would be able to probably see them.
Caesar definitely is aware, because the first thing he tells us in chapter 8 is that he's preparing for battle.
Mm.
And of course, he's looking at the landscape. He's looking at the environment he's in, and he's making sure that he's got control of it. So he's picking a spot that is good for his camp, and he's looking at where he's going to be able to fight this conflict.
Mm, okay.
And he chooses, he says, to put up the camp in a place naturally suitable and appropriate for forming the line of battle. So he's looking for a place where they can be safe, but also where they can easily get to a battleground that works well for him.
Yeah, and he mentions as well that the camp is on a bit of a hill, so they've got the high ground.
They do, and it stands up a little from the plain, which is a space where they might have the battle, of course. At the front, there's a broad space, and it's the right breadth for a line of troops to be deployed. They form a line so that the enemy can't surround them. So they don't want to be on this hill and besieged, basically.
Mm.
And they leave two legions back in the fort, which are troops that Caesar can call on if he needs them. So he's got backup.
Okay.
And they have this initial standoff, but there's a marsh there.
In the middle between
them. Yeah, Caesar says a small marsh.
Mm.
And the Gauls, or the Belgae, I should say, are obviously keen. They're hoping that the Romans don't know about this, so they'll get stuck in the marsh. But basically nobody wants to cross it. That's the end of that day, and we spend the night in camp with Caesar's troops.
Yeah, that's the worst terrain to have a battle on, I suppose, because it'll really slow you down if you suddenly decide to charge and run across it.
Yeah.
And you could get picked off quite easily.
Yeah, and here in this chapter, Caesar's showing us that he does have control of the landscape, that he does his research, and he doesn't just let his men run into uneven territory where they might be in danger.
He's a very good leader.
He likes to give us that impression, certainly.
Okay, so the Belgae, as a result of this, decide to attack by another route. And while there's a river, there's also a handy bridge, possibly built by the Romans, last left in the guard of Sabinus.
So the Belgae, Caesar tells us, and so this is a quote from chapter 9. There they found fords, ways of crossing the river, and endeavoured to throw parts of their forces across, intending, if they could, to storm the fort commanded by the Lieutenant General Quintus Titurius. It's an imaginative translation. Lieutenant General, I think that's definitely made equivalent to something in the British Army. And they try to break down the bridge. Or, their other intention, if they found that impossible, to lay waste the lands of the Remi, which were of great service to us for the conduct of the campaign, and so cut off our supplies. This is something we often see Caesar characterising different Gallic peoples as being indecisive. So these Belgae, their primary intention is to get across the river to attack the Roman camp. But even if they don't do that, at least they can lay waste some Remi territory. You know, it's a bit wishy-washy, isn't it? That's the technical term, I think. If they just had one aim in mind and thought about a strategy to do it.
It kind of shows how much of a strong position Caesar has put himself in at the moment. There's no way for them to successfully attack Caesar. So they're just doing everything a bit out of desperation to see what will work.
Mm.
I'm surprised they didn't rush across the marsh just to see what would happen at that point. If they've got 296,000 troops, why not just send a few? But they didn't do that. So Caesar's in a position of strength, but at the same time, Caesar's on the defensive here.
Well, he's potentially trapped, but he is very well defended, and that's what he's trying to make clear to us.
Mm.
So in chapter 10, Caesar turns this around so that he's not on the defensive. He turns towards the attack. And he does this very quickly, which is typical of him. He leads the cavalry and the light-armed Numidians, as he called them, and the slingers and archers, so those auxiliaries, along with the cavalry, across the bridge. And remember, he's got command of the best way to get across the river because he's left that under guard.
Fierce was the engagement fought there.
Yes, which we can imagine is almost a euphemism for a lot of blood and guts and death.
Yeah, and dead bodies floating down the river.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It writes itself, but, you know, a bit more detail would have helped there, Caesar.
Well, you've hit upon something here, which you may or may not want to leave in here. There's often complaints about the way ancient historians write battles, that modern readers want more detail, but this is what we get. This is what they want us to know. What he does want us to know is that the Roman troops are not in the best position because sometimes they're in the river and they're still fighting and they kill a huge number of the Belgae even from being in the river, which of course, you know, holds you back. There's a current and you're wet and etc.
Mm.
He says the remainder, as they endeavoured with the utmost gallantry to cross over the bodies of their comrades, they drove back with a cloud of missiles. So they're getting rid of the rest of the Belgae.
Well, that kind of tells you the amount of dead that are in the river. The Belgae were actually trying to run across their bodies at that point, human raft themselves to the other side.
Yeah.
How can you fight while doing that?
It does look like an absolute melee, doesn't it? It looks like a mess. The first party, he says, who were already across, the cavalry surrounded and slew. This is often a way of rounding off a battle. Hard, fierce battle. We managed to overcome them. And then you round it up by saying, often it is the cavalry because they've got the speed. They round up the rest of them. So yet again, Caesar's showing us how disorganized the Gauls are in chapter 11. He emphasizes this great uproar and commotion in no definite order under no command, each seeking for himself the first place on the road and hurrying to reach home, so they made their departure seem like a flight. I like the building up of it there, right? Uproar in no definite order under no command. There's this repetition of negatives. The Belgae, when it comes to it, they might be fierce, they might be scary fighters, but they've got no organization.
Yeah.
And this is probably quite unfair to the Gauls, who had been very successful as a military force. But it's the fact that they don't act together that Caesar wants to stress. He claims that this is the reason the Romans are successful against them. There may be some of that in that the Romans are more organized. They kind of got more foresight. We've seen that he's thinking ahead. Where's the corn supply? Where's the land that might suit us best? That's the difference he wants to make with the Gauls.
Mm. The cavalry attack the rearguard and slay great many, which is exactly what they did to the Helvetii at the end of the last campaign. Anybody fleeing, we'll run after you and cut you down.
Yeah.
Bit of a message to those who survive. So the next day, when the dust settles, Caesar surveys the terrain as it is, and the Belgae are not going to offer that much resistance now. They're on the back foot.
Yeah. So Caesar, remember, he's got this stronghold position with the Remi. He moves over the border to a group called the Suessiones. So they're next to the Remi and they're part of the uprising.
Yep.
And he's making his presence known, basically. And he presses right on, and the translation says with a forced march, which the Latin will say as fast as possible, but that's what it means. That means they go a long way to the town of Noviodunum. So this is obviously an important town for him to make his presence known amongst the Suessiones. So Caesar lays out a siege of this important town, and he kind of doesn't have to do the siege itself because the Suessiones are so overcome by seeing the size of the Roman siege works that they give up before the siege starts. So this is in chapter 12, and he literally says, he calls them the Gauls here, the Gauls were prevailed upon by the size of the siege works, which they had not seen or heard of before. This is all new to them, this kind of monstrous, you know, big siege engines.
Yeah, so he's got ramps set up, towers constructed, and he mentions mantlets, and I Googled that. It's like a kind of a barrier thing that's set up with a lean-to on one side, and you can like fire over the top of it. So it's essentially just a barricade thing that you hide behind. All right, so they hadn't seen anything like that before, and they've got towers and ramps coming and everything like that. So that's enough just to scare them into throwing open the gates, more or less.
Exactly. And as Caesar again stresses, it's not only these siege works, but also the rapidity of the Romans. Yeah. So how they got there so quickly, remember those forced marches, and they've put these siege works together really quickly. And I love the way this is expressed. They send deputies to Caesar to treat for surrender, and they send them to the Remi interceding for their salvation, and they obtained their request. So this is Caesar as merciful. All right, if you give up straight away, Caesar will be merciful. Of course, Caesar doesn't have to risk any troops in this scenario, because he's impressed them so much, he's overwhelmed them, that they've just given up even before there's a fight. So this is win-win for the Romans. Also makes short work of the remaining Belgae tribes. Once this town has gone, Noviodunum, the leading men of the state and two sons of the king, who's called King Galba.
No relation.
No relation to the future Emperor Galba in Rome. They're accepted as hostages. All right, so this is a good move. Sons of a king have been given as hostages to Caesar. And various towns surrender quickly. And we've got the Aeduan leader, Duiciacus, pleading for one of these tribes, the Belluarchi. And Caesar, is merciful, but he does accept 600 hostages. So he's merciful, but not trusting.
Look, I don't blame him at this point.
In chapter 14, I'm not going to read all of it, but if anyone wants to read it in detail, we get from Diwikiarchus an explanation of why some of the Belgae might be a bit resistant. And he basically says they've been incited by their chiefs who declare that the Aedui have been reduced to slavery by Caesar. So they've seen the Aedui, who, remember, are those people who are kind of the Romans' best friends in Gaul.
Mm-hmm.
And Diwikiarchus is one of them. And he's been an informant back in book one too. They've seen them and they've said, well, you're just patsies for the Romans. Why should we become like that? So he's giving this explanation for why there has been a reluctance on the part of the Belgae, which is an interesting counter view. It's interesting that Caesar bothers to give us this because it is describing empire as slavery.
Especially considering this is after the fact. He's essentially won and mopping up at this point.
Exactly, yes. So it could just be triumphalist, but no, we get the doubts of some of the conquered or about to be conquered expressed here.
Yes.
And there is one group that refuses to lay down in front of Caesar at this point, and they're called the Nervii.
Yeah, so now we get like essentially a build-up. We're going to be left at a cliffhanger for what's going to be happening in the next part of book two.
Yes.
And this is the big menace that
we've created more of a cliffhanger by ending our podcast here.
We decided to leave the podcast after chapter 15. So who are the Nervii?
Well, they're a group of Belgae who are, in Caesar's terms, more like the Germani than the rest of the Belgae, who are already quite like the Germani. They are geographically closer, gone through the Suessiones, and the Nervii are further east still.
Mm.
So they're not quite on the Rhine, but they're a lot closer. Caesar kind of goes into ethnography mode briefly here. They don't get much trade. This is always important, whether people have contact with other cultures, more sophisticated cultures, perhaps through trade. The Nervii seem to just refuse it. In particular, they don't allow the import of wine. The wine versus beer thing is often important in drawing up these cultural differences for Caesar and other ancients. All right, the Romans don't really understand beer. It's this weird thing that northern barbarians drink.
He gives us an explanation. They supposed that their spirit was like to be enfeebled and that their courage relaxed thereby.
Yeah. Wine makes you weak.
Yeah.
Basically what they're saying.
You drink too much of it? Yeah, fair enough.
And of course, Roman wine was very strong. He says, this is a great description of them, fierce men they were, of great courage, denouncing and accusing the rest of the Belgae for that they had surrendered to Rome and cast away the courage of their sires. For themselves, they affirmed they would send no deputies and accept no terms of peace.
Mm. Yeah.
This is pretty absolute, isn't it? We're not having the Romans here. We don't let the outsiders in. We don't even let wine in. So this is going to be the next source of conflict for Caesar.
And they'd actually assembled and they were ready to meet the Roman troops. So this is a threat that Caesar needs to deal with right away.
Yeah, they've assembled. They've got a position next to a river. Again, we see a river as a strong position strategically. They're along the river Sabis, awaiting the coming of the Romans. And they've got two other tribes with them, the Atrebates and the Viromandui. And they're awaiting further forces from a group called the Aduatuci. And interestingly, that the women and all who by reason of age were deemed useless for battle had been collected together in a district to which there was no approach by the army. So they're prepared. Unlike what we've seen before, these are Gauls who are prepared. These are Belgae who've done a bit of work beforehand and they've hidden away those who they don't consider worthy of battle so that the Romans can't get at them and presumably blackmail them into surrendering.
Yeah, so they can't take hostages. They're out of harm's way. Yeah, they've really done their homework here. But I mean, I remember, you know, Athens doing that kind of stuff when the Persians were on the warpath. So, age-old tactic.
Yeah. It does show that they've approached this with some caution. They're fierce fighters, but they've also made sure they've got their strongest facing the Romans.
Mm.
And really, Caesar is setting this up as a formidable conflict.
It's a great cliffhanger, though, to end it on. So, fierce men they were, of great courage, denouncing and accusing the rest of the Belgae for that they had surrendered to Rome and cast away the courage of their sires.
For themselves, they affirmed that they would send no deputies and accept no terms of peace. Well, Wasn't that thrilling? I don't know about you, but I need a trip to the baths. I wonder what will happen next. Well, for that, you're going to have to attend the next dispatch from Gaius Julius Caesar's campaign in Gaul. I know, a cliffhanger. You'll live. Ave.